There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic to have you on.
Great.
I followed your AMA a few days ago.
Yeah, I just got into weird trouble for it because I had an interview. It's kind of long and complicated. I don't want to take it all.
No, we have time. What is it?
But I have a show in San Diego or near San Diego in Encinitas this weekend with my two different live shows and two different feature films. And I have a very specific writer that I send out to. I don't have a publicist. I mean, there's a publicist here that's working for the film that I'm also promoting that I'm in, called The Bagman. But I don't normally have a publicist as a. This is hired by the company. So I have a specific way of getting around it because I book my shows myself. I have an agent for my films as a film actor.
Sure.
But I don't have an agent that books my live shows and tour around with my films because it's a very specific venue. I have to be in a 35mm cinema that also has a stage, essentially. If it was 1945 or 1940 or 30, you know, the vaudeville circuit, there would be agents that would be able to book what I'm doing, kind of.
Yeah.
But they would. But now there is no such thing. It's just there are comedians that get booked into live houses, mm-hmm. but mine isn't just a live house. It's a 35mm cinema. So I have all of these specifics of how I do interviews, and I do a lot of interviews, actually, way more than most people. And I on Reddit, maybe it was the first time I ever publicly put it. I put that I have a 1,700-page Word document, which is true, actually. And that's actually, I even lost, last year, I lost my computer. And I lost probably about 400 pages of that, maybe 300, I don't know. Not that it matters that much. But, I mean, to be fair, probably 300 of those pages or 400 of those pages are repeats of something that I'll say. Like, I'll say it right now just because I know we'll get to it. What is it? My first film. Most of the actors in the film have Down syndrome, but it's not about Down syndrome. What it really is my psychological reaction to the corporate constraints that have happened in the last 30 years of filmmaking or so, wherein anything that can possibly make an audience member uncomfortable is necessarily excised, or that film will not be corporately funded or distributed. I think it's a very damaging thing when that happens because it's that moment when an audience member sits back in their chair, looks up at the screen, thinks to themselves, is this right what I'm watching? Is this wrong what I'm watching? Should I be here? Should the filmmaker have done this? What is it? And that's the title of the first film. What is it that's taboo in the culture? And what does it mean when the taboo has been ubiquitously excised? I think this is a very damaging thing because it's that moment when people are genuinely asking questions. There's a real thoughts are occurring. And the meaning of the word education etymologically is to learn from within. So when people are truly asking questions, that is genuine education. And to ubiquitously excise our genuine education in our corporately funded and distributed film media is an extremely damaging thing. Now, I said that I don't know how many times. I mean it too. It's not something that I'm just like.
No, but you've had to answer that question a lot.
Right, because it's my soundbite essentially for that movie. And I also have essentially the exact same thing written. And I have a number of other things in those 1,700 pages that are written. And so when I'm doing my tour, sometimes I'm genuinely slammed. Like I'll have three interviews in a single day just because maybe one venue has somebody that's late. Like this just happened in Canada. I had a venue and the guy didn't get it until like the day before. And I was on a train going up to Canada. My lines were in and out. I had to do a whole bunch of interviews in a row. I did that one and then two other interviews and I cut and paste from these things. I don't try to hide it. But apparently the interviewer had requested a voice interview, which I grant. There are certain publications that absolutely it's mandatory that they have a voice interview, and I'm glad to give it to those because those are, you know, skilled interviewers. As you know, it's a skill. And there are good people that get you to say different interesting things than you would normally do, and I'm all for doing them. But realistically, many of the journalists, they're on a deadline. They have three things. They don't really care about my show and film, and they're very happy to get this cut and paste that they can just put it, edit and put into their 300 word page thing. Yeah. But this journalist got really mad and then she like posted this like negative thing that I'd snubbed her, which I hadn't. It was because, and it sounds crazy, but it's like I have a very specified writer because of this very thing. And I say in the writer that everything should go to publicity at CrispinGlover.com. And I was in the middle of the junket for the Bagman last week. And I really was slammed. And I was looking to see, I probably looked in publicity at CrispinGlover.com. I might have gotten the thing. The guy sent it to me at booking at CrispinGlover.com.
So there was a
mix-up.
Yeah.
And so, but she like wrote this mean thing about me in the paper, so I don't know.
Well, the problem is that I think that most people always, because I get that happen. I get that happens to me more than no times. It's actually happens quite a bit where you do something and people assume the worst about you as to why it happened. Well, you were a dick or you fucked this up. And it's like, no, I'm sorry. There was, and then you explain and they go, oh, okay. It's like, yeah, but you already shit all over me.
But she, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I was asking was please change it. Like it's on the web now. You can change these.
Or
things.
At least ask the question, you know, why did this happen as opposed to, well, you did this cause you're a dick. No, I didn't. I was trying to do
but
my best.
But then even when I was going about it, she was saying, yeah, but this, you didn't anyhow.
Well, there's not at a certain point. I guess you know what you can do is just go. Fine, I'm a dick. What do you want? I give I don't know.
I'm not trying to hide that I do. I actually give much better answers on some level for a written interview when. Like, well, she'd asked me a very specific question about how my books are. In fact, I have some here. Thanks. Even though nobody can see it, I'll show you guys. These are the books that and you can have them too.
Thank you so much. I lost that one in a
move. Oh, you had one?
Move. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Concrete Inspection.
I lost this one. Like, I lost a box of stuff, and two of the things in there were this and your CD.
Oh, good. Yeah. I appreciate you. You're talking about Rat Catching, and this is Oakmont.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you can have those.
These are awesome.
Yeah, I'm proud of these. And these are what the live show that I perform. I have two different live shows that I perform before the two different feature films, which I'll be at the Las Palmas Theater. It's on CrispinGlover.com.
Okay.
Friday and Saturday. And I perform a 1 hour live dramatic narration of these eight different books. And then I have the feature film. These are two, there's two different live shows, there's two different feature films. Then I have a 1.5 hour question and answer period. And then I have a book signing, and I stay till the last person is there to have their book signed.
So you have two somewhat connected, but essentially separate things. You are an actor for hire sometimes.
That's
and
correct.
Then most of the time, you're creating films, books, music. I mean, basically just which we can get into a little bit more. But Where do you go mentally to go, okay, today I'm just being hired to say someone else's words and this is their vision and
Thing I see written about me, where the word just is used, where they say Crispin just acted in Charlie's Angels, for example, to fund Everything Is Fine. I've seen that written many times because I've publicly let it be known that I did use the money that I made from the first Charlie's Angels film to fund the second film, It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine, which I might as well, now that I mentioned that, I'll tell what that's about.
Sure.
One of the actors in Everything Is Fine, named Stephen C. Stewart, had been born, and he's the writer and the main actor of It Is Fine, Everything Is Fine. And he was born with a severe case of cerebral palsy, and he was difficult to understand his speech. And when his mother died in his early 20s, he was put into a nursing home where he really did not want to be. And the people that were taking care of him there would derisively call him an MR, a mental retard, which is not a nice thing to say to anybody. But Steve was of normal intelligence, and the emotional turmoil he must have gone through for the decade he was in that nursing home, I can't even begin to imagine. But when he got out, he wrote this screenplay in the style of a 1970s TV murder mystery movie of the week, wherein he's the bad guy. And this was something that was very important to Steve. He talked about it. If you think about it, in a corporately funded or distributed film, if there's a character that has a disability, basically that character will be a benefactor to society. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. There's plenty of people with disabilities that are benefactors to society. But Steve's point was that he was a person with a disability, emphasis on a person, and people can have dark thoughts. And he wanted to play a guy with dark thoughts, and he does. And there's something about the fact that he wrote it in this genre style as opposed to a standard autobiography. There's certain truths that come out in a dynamic, a counterpoint to this genre that is just really beautiful. There's an emotional catharsis that happens that I'm very proud of. When the whole trilogy is done, this film will be the best film in the whole trilogy. But not only that, I feel like it'll be the best film I'll have anything to do with in my whole career. I feel very strongly about the movie. People often ask, because when I play two nights in a row, like I will this weekend in Encinitas, I play Everything Is Fine first, even though it's part two of the trilogy. The films are thematically related. I shot What Is It first, but for a lot of different reasons, I show Everything Is Fine first. And people don't have to worry about it. They don't have to see What Is It first. Come and see Everything Is Fine first, and it'll be okay. And I perform Crispin Helion Glover's big slideshow part two with that one, which is first. So it doesn't matter. There are eight different books. It's not something you won't make sense out of.
So what gets activated for you with these? Because the presentation of these films sound different in this, or at least they sound different to me. Maybe I'm wrong. But for What Is It? Just this idea of like, well, you're trying to make people ask questions and make them face how they feel about certain things. And it sounds like the second film is, I really want to sort of tell this guy's meta story by allowing him to explore this thing. So what is it that what are you trying to do with these films?
Well, specifically, like I kind of said in that soundbite, I mean, when I started making What Is It, it was a short film, and I was just reacting to something emotionally, but I've deduced, self-analyzed what it is. I mean, I was aware of it as I expanded from a short film into a feature film. Specifically, what happened was, it's such a long story, but I'm trying to condense it.
You don't have to.
Well, I want to talk about a lot of things.
Well, we'll get to it. We have time.
But the What Is It was originally going to be a short film to promote a different feature film screenplay, which I came in and started to rewrite because two young writers wanted me to act in a film. I said I would be, and they approached my agents with a monetary offer. This was 96, and around that time I decided the first-time corporately funded filmmaker that I worked with, it should be me. I was under the impression they had money because they made a monetary offer.
Sure.
So I read the script, but they actually didn't have money, which anyhow, it was okay. There were interesting things about their screenplay, and I said to them, I would be interested in acting it if I could rework some of the concepts and direct it. There was a problem in the screenplay that was solved from my point of view of how to solve it. I'd already been writing a lot of screenplays, and some of them had elements with actors utilizing actors with Down syndrome where they'd play a character that had Down syndrome or sometimes they wouldn't. In this particular case, I saw, this will solve this particular problem in this screenplay. So I said to them, if I could rework it and make it so that a majority of the characters were to be played by actors with Down syndrome, then I'd like to do this. And they were okay with that. I set about to rewriting the screenplay, and then David Lynch agreed to executive produce it for me, which was a great thing for him to do. He's a great person. I'm really grateful to him for that. So, executive production can mean somebody has a lot of money, or it can mean there's somebody like David Lynch who it's going to attract money to your project. So I went into one of the larger corporate companies here in Los Angeles that funds so-called independent film, and they were interested. And I had a number of name actors that were interested, and David Lynch, of course, is an executive producer. But after a number of meetings and conversations, they let me know that they were concerned about funding a film wherein a majority of the characters were to be played by actors with Down syndrome. So it was decided that I should write a short screenplay that would be a short film to promote this as a viable idea. I wrote a 20-something page screenplay called What Is It? And then we shot that in 4 days. And what I wrote originally was that all of the characters are to be played by actors with Down syndrome. I edited that together on Adobe Premiere. At that time, nobody was editing long-term. I remember being on technical support with Adobe Premiere. It was QuickTime still would go out of sync at like 1.5 minutes. And it was a big deal when it finally sunk a long time. But I was like on the technical support phone when it was still like a lot of money to be long distance saying I'm trying to make a long-form movie with this technology. And they said, there's somebody else in Idaho who's doing that. It was not normal at that time to be doing that. By the time I finished, I had a terrible technical problem with SMPTE time code that cost literally 5 years. But anyhow, that's a long part of it. So I edited this together in 6 months. The short film came together at 84 minutes. The current film is 72 minutes. So it was longer than what I had, and I had 8 more days of shooting I ended up doing after that. But I realized with more work I could turn it into a feature film. But more importantly, I realized that what the corporate entity was concerned about was not the viability of having a majority of the characters played by actors with Down syndrome, but it was the concept of having a majority of the characters played by actors with Down syndrome wherein those characters do not necessarily have Down syndrome. Now that seems like not a big deal. I wasn't thinking of it as a big deal, but corporate interests can get concerned about maybe somebody asking a question like, why are you doing this? Are you making fun of these people? Yeah. Are you taking advantage of these people? Which, no, I would hate that. I have no interest in making fun of anybody with any kind of disability. It's just not my sense of humor in the least. It wasn't on my mind, but I realized, but even more than that, what they're concerned about, and this starts to get political, and some people would say it's paranoid, but just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. but the fact of it is corporations at this point in time, solidly, with forethought and knowledge, do not want an informed and thoughtful populace. The reason is because corporations are here to because the money is given to by this so-called democratic society. In the, originally, democ- in, when corporations were first allowed to happen in the United States. I could be wrong about the term, but I believe it was called a lock stock company. And the lock stock companies had to get permission from the government to exist. And there was a time limit on how long they had to accomplish what their writ was, what they were supposed to do. Once they accomplished that thing, the corporation was dismissed because it was understood that a corporation, if it had increasing power, could start doing negative things. Well, corporations made money. I'm sure they were able to bribe people, and the laws got changed. And it got changed so that corporations became legally people, which of course is very strange. Then just in the last few years, the Supreme Court made a decision that money is a form of speech, and therefore people, corporations, have the right to speak slash put money into the ears slash pockets of politicians. It's legalized bribery. That is the way things work in all of our politics right now. It's totally corrupt. It has to be stopped. And I'm very happy because, see, I kind of got off track, but what is it was ultimately reacting to that? What is it? I realized that corporations do not want people to ask questions because if people ask questions and are informed and thoughtful, they'll put them out of business, which is what needs to happen. I don't mean that 100%. What needs to happen is that human beings need to be put first, and corporations, it needs to be understood that they're only there to serve people, and that if they're not serving people and they're doing damage to people, which they are right now, they need to be shut down. They need to be heavily regulated, and that's not happening because of the legalized bribery. But I don't care about any of this in a certain way, because I hate actors that go out and be political. But while I'm on the subject, there is a site called wolf-pack.org about where you sign up for getting this amendment passed. I'm totally behind it. It does need to happen, and I think it will. Strangely, and this is a corporate newspaper, the New York Times just came out with an article saying that this is so, that the legalized bribery is a real situation that needs to be dealt with, which is great, because it is. I can't believe anybody would argue this unless they're a politician who's getting their campaign paid for by the corporation that wants the law changed. Those are the only people that are going to argue against it. Everybody else knows that that is not good to be happening in a so-called democracy. Anyhow, what I was reacting to, I don't like to be political. I want to be artistic. That's what my interest is. That's what my, luckily and happily, my job essentially is. So I was reacting to this because I realized way back in 96 that corporations do not want questions to be asked. And if you have something that's could make people uncomfortable, that people could go, well, why are you doing this? That starts to form thoughts. So I realized this as I was changing what is it into a feature film, that I needed to put this into the tapestry of what the movie was, meaning taboo. Another word for it is taboo. And so if taboo is the tapestry of the film, because there is no, you will not find corporately funded and distributed films that deal with taboo in any way, shape, or form, because I am quite certain of what I'm talking about. This is a controlled element. And I'm on this political rant, but I talk about this at my shows with What Is It, but if anybody gets anything out of this, maybe the most important thing is a book that was written way back in 1928 by a man named Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. The reason Sigmund Freud was brought into the United States was because his nephew, Edward Bernays, understood that his uncle's understanding of the human subconscious would be able to be utilized for corporate interests in media, politics and or government and academia in order to control the underclass so that the corporations essentially would be able to get what they want to get across. I'll read, and he's the literal father of the public relations industry. When you hear the word public relations, just understand that it was a synonym that was introduced by Edward Bernays to replace the word propaganda. They're the same word. And he was trying, what's amazing about this book, I'll read you the two opening sentences of it. It was written in 1928. This is not an expose, like, or fiction. Like, 1984 is what people classically think of when they hear the word propaganda, which is great. It's a great book. It's a great work of fiction, and I think George Orwell inverted 84 with 48, and he was making a commentary on how people were in Britain at the time just after World War II, and it's a great book. But what's amazing about this book, Propaganda, so people think about that, and then they think about like Nazi Germany, or they think about communist Russia as to what is how propaganda is used, which is usually a committee.
Or North Korea now.
Or, you know, I mean, there's a billion examples. Well, including the United States.
Sure.
There is, in fact, there's no exception. There's no yeah. exception of any form of government that won't use propaganda. That's what should be the foregone conclusion. But somehow, because the propaganda is so well done and so well disguised in the United States, people think, no, we don't have propaganda. Of course there's propaganda in the U.S., but it's a far more insidious, unfortunately, than people realize, and it's far more infused into the society, and of course propaganda works, and then it gets into people's heads and they don't even realize they're propagandized. The best propagandists are the ones that think what they're doing is right. Yeah. But here's the first two sentences of Propaganda by Edward Bernays from 1928. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. What's amazing about this is that it's not an expose, it's an instruction manual. He's saying this as a positive element, that propaganda is what will help control.
Here's all you got to do.
Yeah.
And you, if you read it, it's an easy book.
It's like a cookbook.
Yeah,
it's like 150 pages. If everybody in the United States read it in high school, then you wouldn't be able to utilize the propaganda in the way that it's utilized. But it's so. I mean, this is something I've been talking about a lot lately. I've been very happy to see since that Occupy movement started, which, you know, that's a complicated movement. But what I got from it that was positive was also what I see the New York Times finally has come out and said is this element of. Corporate interests using legalized bribery for their own interests to the negative element of the culture and society as a whole. And that has to be reacted to. But I knew this way back in 96. I had a very specific incident that happened when I was in Back to the Future where I asked about the moral element in the outcome of the... how the film ended, because I had not been given the script before I agreed to do the film. I was, you know, 20 years old. I didn't.
What was the moral question?
Money makes everything better.
Well, exactly. You've heard me talk about it. It's something that I've started becoming vocal about very specifically. I wouldn't have talked about it, but there's this producer on the film named Bob Gale.
Co-writer. Oh yeah, I read about the AMA thing.
Yeah, and he's lied about me. He said there are millions of people that believe this guy I had a lawsuit about this thing. You know, they put a false nose, chin, and cheekbones onto another actor from the original molds of my face. That were used to make the old age makeup for the first film.
And they flipped them upside down.
Well, they did all kinds of things to obfuscate him, and then they took images, just very brief images of my close-ups of my face, and interspliced it with this other actor to make fool audiences into believing that I was in the film. Because of my lawsuit, there are now rules in the Screen Actors Guild that make it so producers and directors can no longer do that kind of thing, which I'm proud of. But, you know, you don't ever really win something like that. There was a negative aspect that happened, and they have... I'm very essentially obsessed with propaganda, but because I can see he utilized propagandistic rules to be, you know, damaging toward me.
Sure.
He has this huge platform on these Blu-rays. It's only recently that he starts, I think, I didn't really listen to them earlier, but I believe he only started saying that I was asking for the same salary as Michael J. Fox, and that's why I'm not in Back to the Future. He's doing this to obfuscate that what they did was illegal. I didn't ask for the same salary as Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox never came up in the negotiations for a second. But he's utilizing the element of you just put out a big lie and then everybody believes it. And now I'm in the position where I've got to either just sit there and say, well, yeah, the lie's true, or I've got to react. So I've got to let it be known.
Well, especially at that time, there was no internet. So it's not like you could just say,
exactly,
here's my story. Yeah. You just, you know, I'm sure with whatever it was, no matter what happened, the guy's a crazy actor. He doesn't know anything.
Exactly. Yeah. I would have had to hire
a propagandist.
Or a publicist, whatever. Exactly. It's all the same word. I mean, obviously, propaganda has a negative connotation.
Sure.
Publicist is a specific job. I mean, you can say what I'm saying is propaganda. Propaganda does not necessarily have to have a negative connotation. And it didn't. Before World War I. That's why Edward Bernays wrote the book in 1928, was because World War I in the U.S., they were saying that Germans, the Huns, were throwing babies into fires to get people in the United States wanting to have a war in World War I. That wasn't happening.
Yeah.
I think Erich von Stroheim played a character, and he was great. He was a great actor, and it's a lot of fun. He was the man you love to hate, and he threw some baby, and he was playing like this World War I German Hun that was a bad guy.
Well, I mean, it's you know, and also because it's attached to a film that's one of the most beloved properties in our culture, that, you know, it's like Tom Wilson's a really good friend of ours, and
yeah, great fellow. Yeah.
Tom was on the podcast a couple years ago, and he was never really comfortable talking about his experience in Back to the Future.
I recently talked to him.
That's what he said. He said you guys had a really great phone conversation.
We did. He and I need to get together and do our own something, because there are specific things, and I shouldn't talk about it because it's his thing.
Sure.
But I noticed that he wasn't a part of this reunion, and I thought I know something's going on. So I talked to him, and he and I need to do something, because the thing is. What for me was very eye-opening about that experience in 1984, and I haven't gotten specifically to what it is. I have started talking about it, but I had not been given the screenplay beforehand, and which was fine with me. I was, you know, 20 years old. It was a big Universal Studios Steven Spielberg movie. Great, you know, they wanted me for what looked like an interesting part. When I read for it, I only read for the one scene. That was the only thing that I had, was the one scene that takes place in the 1950s. And I didn't even know that I was going to play the older parts. There's what they call a screen test, which is up on YouTube. It isn't. It's a makeup test that was done after. It's an old age makeup test that was done after I was already hired to do the film. But, you know, so my agent was the one that told me I'd be playing these older characters when I got the offer. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Yes, let's close this deal. Great. So I read the screenplay after I closed the deal. And it wasn't like I read the screenplay and thought, this is terrible. No, I read the screenplay and thought, this is an amazing part. This is great. But I was, you know, I trained professionally from acting from 15 till 20. My father's an acting teacher. I never formally studied with him as an actor, but...
Bruce Glover,
yeah. Who's in my... I'm showing 10 minutes of a film that I started shooting last year, October, for the first time he and I have ever acted together in a film. So that's something I'm showing, 10 minutes of contiguous edited material. It's something I shot on my first film that was shot on 35mm negative. My first two films were shot on 16mm negative with a digital intermediate, and then now I travel with the two 35mm prints of the films. In any case,
You had been training since you were 15, and you had read the script.
So, I was, you know, I was serious about my acting. And part of what you do is you figure out the psychology of the character. You want to get to the truth of the character. And at the end of the screenplay, there's more to it that I won't go into here. But there was something that I asked a question about which did get changed. But there was another thing that was related to that thing that got changed, which was that the characters had money when they came back to this alternate future. And it had come from what the other part of my questioning was, but I retained that there was still this element that if there is money given, I see people have reacted to it and they say, oh, well, what's wrong with getting money? There's nothing wrong with getting money. And I mean, you could make an argument that money is a weird thing in society. Yes, you can make that argument, but let's just say this is this society, so okay, it's understandable how we regard what money is. But what I was arguing was that the message, putting the message out with it being a reward, is a bad message. Basically, that money equals happiness. What I was arguing was that if we were, you know, they wanted me to be wearing certain clothes, and I think they even made commentary on one of the DVDs where they said I was just upset about my hair, my clothes. What I, you know, kind of denigrated me because there'd been a lawsuit, which is what they've essentially continued to do ever since that. But no, I wasn't upset about that. I was upset about what the content was, and so I didn't want to get fired. They had just fired another actor. Eric Stoltz was fired from the Michael J. Fox part, the part Michael J. Fox played, ended up playing, and we had just shot the scene, which I had this question about, right before Eric Stoltz was fired. So it was made pretty clear to me that this was essentially my test. Like, I felt like I was next. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but they had just fired somebody else. So, you know, we had shot it in a slightly different way previously. And then when we reshot it with Michael J. Fox playing the part, it was, you know, made very clear they wanted me in this kind of clothing. And I go into a lot more detail about it in other ways. But this is what it stems from, me not being in the sequels and what this lawsuit ended up being about. I mean, there's more complexity to it, but it's just like, I don't even know how we got onto that.
Well, I think it's interesting. What, you know, the thing that's interesting to me about it is maybe 20-year-old actors are different now, but I can't imagine a 20-year-old actor in today's world going,
you're right.
Are you sure this is the moral center
of what we're talking? You know why? Is because I was 16 in 1980, and this is why propaganda works. When I was 16 and I was learning how to act, I learned how to drive. I started going to all of the revival theaters that were popular in Los Angeles. And so the movies, of course, they were showing were movies from the 1970s and the 1960s. And if you think about those decades, I mean, they were showing films from the 20s and 30s, but essentially the people that were programming these venues were of that era when people were questioning things. And this is what I thought was happening in the film world. I was excited about this as a young actor. I was thinking, this is great. I'm going to be part of this industry which questions things that should be questioned. And then I'm starting to look around as an actor, and that very specific incident happened to me. And I questioned, thinking, I didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal, but those people, they got mad. I mean, really mad.
I mean, it's, you know, the juxtaposition, well, the brain that you had going into the corporatiest machine.
That's right.
It's a really interesting idea that you even, and how do you even reconcile, or how were you able to reconcile working after that?
First off, after Back to the Future came out, it made so much money, I did feel an obligation towards finding characters or screenplays specifically that did somehow psychologically reflect what my interests are. The first film that I acted in after Back to the Future came out was River's Edge, mm-hmm. which is a film I'm very proud of still. Subsequent to that, in the 80s and 90s, I mean, I still tried to find directors or characters or something that would have something questioning or interesting, but most of the films that I acted in did not necessarily specifically reflect what my psychological interests were. They did not necessarily make that much money, and that was not necessarily that good for my acting career. I don't regret the time, because essentially this persona that I still have with me to this day, approximately, was etched out, and I'm basically comfortable with that. But so I don't regret it. But then what happened was, in 1999, I shot with Steve. I told Steve and C. Stewart, the guy who wrote Everything Is Fine, that we were going to write him into what is it when I expand it into a feature, and I put myself in as an antagonistic element within it. I replaced the original antagonistic structure. I kept the protagonistic structure from the short film basically the same and then expanded it. So Steve was written into Everything Is Fine. We shot with him in 96, and cerebral palsy is not a degenerative disease, but in 1999, he was getting older. He was 62 by the time we shot, and which was shot in 2000 and 2001. But in 99, one of his lungs collapsed because he was starting to choke on his own saliva, and he got pneumonia. And that happened. So it became apparent if we didn't shoot something soon, we may never get to shoot anything at all. And with... it was right around the time that the first Charlie's Angels film was coming to me. 3 years before, I would have just said no to that script. I did read the script. And even with this pressure, when I looked at it, if you've seen the character I play in it, I don't say anything. I'm a silent character. But the original script that I read, the character had a lot of dialogue, and the dialogue was extremely expositional, which is not necessary. And I wasn't going to go in, but they kept calling my agent. They said they wanted to know what I thought about it. So I did go in, and they asked what my ideas were, and I said I thought whether I played it or not, the character should just be a silent, fighting, antagonistic character. And the director, McGee, who can be very enthusiastic, stood up and said, "That's great. That's exactly what we're going to do. That's how we're going to do it. That's fantastic." And then they showed me the Yuen family, the Chinese team, that were going to be choreographing the wire work and martial arts. And I had known their work, and that those guys are great, and those guys genuinely understand psychology of character through movement. And I realized with this being a quiet, silent character and those guys choreographing it, this could really be interesting, and I would be able to fund Steve's film, which is exactly what ended up happening. I shot the film. And so it's like people say just, you know, I was saying that earlier, Crispin just acted in that film. I investigated. I wouldn't just do a film if I felt like it would be embarrassing is maybe the right word.
Sure.
Like, I know that I've been in films that are not considered good films, but I'm still, and I might have even been aware of it when I was reading the screenplay, but I thought, is there a way that I can somehow make this entertaining or enjoyable or thoughtful or anything? Because that decade, starting in 2000, after Charlie's Angels came out and I was able to fund Steve's film, that film made a lot of money, which was good for my acting career, which is how it works. If you're in big movies, you get more offers. I think people, this was my kind of misconception, is that if you're right for the part, you'll get an offer. There's some truth in that, but if you're in the number one movie and you're right for the part, then you'll get it.
Well, I think and certainly what I intended by it is that...
And you're not the only person who says it.
No.
I mean, it happens a lot.
But maybe I can... Here's what I assume people are thinking, because I'll tell you what I'm thinking, and then maybe this is...
Yeah.
Which is, you are essentially the creator of all this other art.
Right.
As opposed to... being hired to say someone else. So I think when they say just, they don't mean like, well, there's no work that comes with that. I think they mean, you know, you are the architect of all this other stuff, the writing and the live shows and the films and the
reason I get concerned about it though is because I do work in the corporate industry. I'm glad to be working in the corporate industry. I get concerned that people in the corporate industry think I'm this ne'er-do-well who like has this anger towards it. I have questions about it, it's true, but I know there's all kinds of great people in the film industry that want to be doing interesting, questioning things. There's a systematization that if you want to get your film made, you have to essentially conform to. And that is how propaganda actually works in the U.S. People have to think upwards. They think, will I get fired if I do this? I get my funding for my film if I do this? Will my film get distribution if I do this? Which is, instead of having a committee that's saying you must do it, it's expensive to make a film. It's expensive to distribute a film. I mean, and I I know, because I've made my own films that I've self-funded and I've self-distributed them. It's not easy. I'd much rather be hired by a corporation and have them distribute my films. But I also know my temperament. Somebody would say, well, we really shouldn't say that. And I just say, this makes sense. And they'd say, that's stupid. And they'd fire me and have somebody else direct the films.
Well, I have a friend who's a director, and he started working with this company, and he said that they started sort of nosing around. They almost point blank said, do you have a lot of debt? Like, they were trying to find out if they could control him.
Exactly. Right.
And he was like, no, I have plenty of money. If you don't want to work with me, I don't give a shit.
And then they
left him alone.
Exactly. Wow.
Because they realized they couldn't.
See, that's exactly how it's a perfect example. And that's not an exception. That's the rule. I've talked to so many people who are filmmakers I was in a lucky position in the fact that I do have worked in the corporate industry, and that corporate publicity has made it so that I can go, even if, like I said, I had this kind of like piece written about me where they, you know, which I started out talking about, where they were kind of slamming me because I'd used my 1,700 word pay document to answer some of the questions. But ultimately, I also realized that doesn't matter. What matters is that the word gets out. Most filmmakers that maybe they've put their house on the line and they're about to get their house taken away, and they do not have the opportunity to go to some community and get that kind of publicity. And then those people end up, they tell me about it. The corporation will say to them, well, you know, we really want to put your movie out. And they figure out that the person's maybe put, what, $250,000, $400,000 in the movie. And they're going to lose their house, so we'll offer you, they don't say that out loud, but they say, we'll offer you $350,000. And the guy goes, okay, well, I'm going to lose, or they'll offer $250,000. And the guy knows he's going to lose $150,000, but that's better than losing $400,000 in his house. So he sells the film at a loss. And then these corporations sell the film. They do make their money back at the $250,000. And then with creative accounting, they never pay that filmmaker. I mean, I've talked to so many filmmakers, that's what happened. That's why I tour with it. I mean, there's a lot of reasons I tour with the film. There's that. There's also that my films have questions and people genuinely get something out of it, as do I.
Well, would you ever want to form like a giant anti-corporation where you could just give people money to pursue artistic endeavors?
If somebody gives me hundreds of millions, yes. I'm not anti-corporate. I'm anti... I'm sincere in what I'm talking about. We need to regulate corporations at this point. It needs to be assured that corporations are in balance with the amount of money that they're getting from the people that are paying for that stuff. And corporations have to do positive things for people. That needs to be controlled. Once that happens, then corporations, you know, there's I've toured up in Norway. And Norway is a very socialist country, which can, you know, be a bad word to a lot of people, but it's people that haven't been there. If you go to Norway, you're going to look and see people are happy. They have money. I mean, it's a rich country, to be fair. I think they made a lot of money off of oil in the just off of their waters that was discovered later in their existence. I don't know when, but I've toured there, and they've got... I'm basing this on that they have cinematheques there, and the cinematheques hire cinephiles, and then the cinephiles get money from the government, and they program what they want. The government leaves them alone. Oh. It's amazing. That's how corporations should run. It should be find people that love what they're doing, that genuinely want to do something beneficial, and let it happen. There's nothing wrong with the idea of a corporation, but when it ends up being for specific profit to some single person, essentially, that's going to have all the ability in the world to, or as much money as they have, to continue to enrich themselves, which is what the purpose of a corporation is. Of course, that's what it's going to do. There have to be regulations. It's just, if we don't, it's going to get way worse to truly nightmarish performance. It's all nightmarish elements, but it's already bad enough. It will get worse. It really is imperative.
I really feel like you needed the internet in the 80s. I feel like so many things happened in your life and your career that you've talked about a million times that totally could have just been dealt with the internet.
You're
between
right.
Back to the Future and the Letterman thing and everything. Or it's just like, one tweet. Yeah. Or just at least allowing people to come together. Because I get the sense that you really kind of enjoy the mystery of some of the things.
Yeah, I leave certain things alone. Like you mentioned the Letterman things. I purposefully leave... when people ask me about that in media, it's different at my shows, but in media, I always say I neither confirm nor deny that I was on the Letterman show, which of course... exactly. It's funny, of course. But you know, it's like... But you're right. If I had an internet in the 80s, it would have been a tremendous thing.
It feels to me, whether intentional or not, and I feel like maybe intentional, that there were a lot of things that you were doing that were sort of fucking around with norms and pop culture and society and maybe at times in the 80s we didn't understand irony yet, and so maybe people didn't quite get what was going on.
Well, there was also a very specific control, which is loosening. I mean, there were certain networks, and then there were certain newspapers or magazines which are corporately controlled. So I recollect, you know, the kinds of interviews I would get in the late 80s, early 90s. Well, early 90s was when I first started touring with the show. And I would do interviews with people. Sometimes you can hear it, I'll kind of stutter or pause. At that time, I very much had, like, people would, like, write in the pauses. And it was always written as though I was this insane person. And so it's actually part of why I do like to write the elongated answers out when I can, because the facts are there. What I want out is out. And so there is an element of control with it. I don't mind giving interviews. I mean, of course, this is like a great interview. You guys are on the thought process, which is enjoyable for me. But then sometimes you'll get an aggressive interview, and not even that's bad, but the thing is, if it's live, it's okay. I actually prefer that, but what they often are is then they hide behind it and they write things, and they genuinely take things out of context to write something.
Well, sure, because
something.
Sometimes I feel like, you know, we have conversations on this show, and I don't come in with any preconceived notions. It's like, well, I just want to get to know you the way you would get to know a human being.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, you know, I feel like, and I don't consider myself a journalist, but I think a journalist might come in and go, and they kind of have an agenda.
Right.
And they have a way, like, I think this is how I'm going to paint this guy. So I'm sure a lot of them come in and be like, Crispin Glover, you're kind of crazy, right? And you're like, no, what are you
talking about? Yeah, I know. I've had it happen. Actually, I just had it happen kind of on the Huffington Post. A strange thing happened. That's a live interview. Anyhow, that's a weird thing. But in Time Magazine, of all things, the first question that was asked of me by the interviewer was, so what's this I hear you about you being difficult to work with? And I said,
that is a very aggressive leading question.
And I said, he wanted to paint that. I had a great experience working on Willard, and you can even see an outtake in the...
I loved Willard.
Glenn Morgan was a great guy. He wrote the film. I had a great working experience with him. And there's an outtake on the DVD, you can even see it, where it's not something that's on, I mean, it's on camera, but I'm like, you can break character. I generally don't when I'm working, but there was something where a rat was like walking somewhere, or he's confused about something. I said, and I quietly, about in this demeanor, I said, is the rat going this way or that way? Something like that. You can see it. You can watch it on the DVD.
Did the rat write a blog post about...
No, the guy on Time Magazine, you can read it. Look it up. And he said, Crispin stormed off the set and said, I didn't know there were going to be rats in this movie. It's like, I mean, like genuinely insane, like psychotic.
Well, the annoying thing about even asking a question like, what's this I hear about, is that it's an impossible you can't answer it because you go, I don't know what you've
you're
heard. How could I possibly
on the defense.
Know? How
yeah.
could I possibly know what
That's
this
right.
thing
it's
you've
a
heard
tactic.
Is?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes that tactic can be used to get somebody kind of riled up. And they'll say something interesting. It's true. But sometimes it's just there to try to make somebody look bad.
Or you could just ask the person a question, a very sincere question. Hey, what was your experience? And then maybe that would come out.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with Bagman? Was this? I mean, do you audition at this point?
I will. I'm very happy to audition, but I generally don't get asked to audition. But sometimes, and I actually kind of miss auditioning. In a certain way, I got most of my work back when I was like 18, 19, 20, when I was auditioning a lot. I had lots of auditions, and my batting average was very good. I'm a good auditioner, or I can be. I mean, everybody has bad auditions, but most of my auditions really did generally go well. But the Bagman was just simply offered to me. I was in the Czech Republic working on overseeing the sets for the film that I just
You have a home there, right? You live in the Czech Republic?
I have in 2003, which was still my best year financially to date, I did the second Charlie's Angels film, Willard, and I always forget the name of it. It was a kid's film with...
Open Season.
No.
To the internet. If only there was some database.
In any case, it's a basketball thing, and I always forget the name of it, and I played the bad guy in it. So it was my best year. There were three studio films in a row. Right after I'd spent all this money on Everything Is Fine, I was like for my worst financial situation.
Like Mike?
Like Mike.
Yeah.
And that was the first. That was the one that actually saved me from my I was. It was very close. It was kind of the worst I'd ever had. Which isn't that bad. I mean, it's, but it's like, no, I was going to miss a payment on my house essentially like the next month if I didn't get a job. So I got that. And then and then those other two films, I took all of that money and I put it into an old chateau that was built in the 1600s.
Oh, wow.
About 45 minutes east of Prague by train. And next to it is a horse stables. I bought it specifically for this reason. It's taken all of this time to get it to the point where I had 17 volunteers that worked on the film we shot. And then for 10 days, 10 pages, and now I have 10 minutes. Actually, there's 20 minutes altogether edited, but I have 10 minutes that I'm showing right now. So it's a 48-page screenplay, which sounds short, but my pages tend towards shooting long for whatever reason. They're standardly formatted, but if anything, I have to cut down. But it's a 48-page, so I have 38 more pages to shoot. Anyhow, I was there, and... we weren't shooting it. I was overseeing the sets, and I got the offer for Bagman. I read the script. The dialogue was really well written for the character. I liked it, and I was on the set within two weeks. I had actually wanted, and I'm doing it today. I just got a film, and I'm growing facial hair out, and the same thing. I wanted to grow facial hair out for that. I actually don't know if I'll use it for this film, but I'm still figuring things out, and I might, and that would be in April. So I have longer for this. I have a month, essentially, but that I only had 2 weeks. I asked if we could have a little bit longer, but there was a specific and tight schedule. So I was on the set within 2 weeks shooting, and I had a great experience. Interestingly, the director self-funded the film, and I think there are good things that can happen out of that. I enjoyed it a lot.
So when you you're given a script, you're looking at a character, or even when you're looking at... you know, something that you're creating yourself. Like, what's ultimately your approach? What questions are you asking? Earlier you said, what does that character want, or what is the essential?
Yeah, that's the basic that I was taught in acting and still go for. But, I mean, you look at different scripts for different reasons or figure out things for different reasons. This one, it was simple. I liked the way the dialogue was written. And so it wasn't... And the dialogue was, the one thing maybe you could criticize about it is that there are certain things that are very clear as to what the character's background is. And I'm not really meaning it as a criticism, but I didn't have to research a lot of stuff. It was on the page. It was in there. And then I just immediately figured out what the character would look like and sound like and played it. I'm happy with how it came out as well. So this was a relatively simple one. Sometimes, you know, it's like I'll look at something and it's like generally I want to work. I'm funding my films. And it's I also know, you know, I'm over 30 years into it as a career. On some level, sometimes there's exceptions, but on some level, it's just good to continue working, even if there's if it's not like the this an award-winning movie or whatever. It's like sometimes just you work to get more work, and then you've got to like figure out, okay, how do I not embarrass myself? That some really, and you, so it's like I'll look and figure out, okay, well, you can see often, like this dialogue is very well written in The Bagman, but in sometimes I'll look at dialogue, and what I mean by that is it can have a depth. You can have more than one thought about it, a question. I like questions in general because I think good art, good thought comes from that. An audience, they have an interactive element when they're asking questions. They become involved and it becomes enjoyable for them. So if there's any kind of nuance within dialogue, it's good, but often, and The Bagman had that, often though, I'll get a script, I'll know I should work, there'll be maybe something intriguing about the character, the cast, or I just need to work, whatever, and I'll look at the page, and I'll look at the dialogue, and I'll see how it was supposed to be said, or it feels like that's how it was supposed to be said by the writer. It feels like you can see it on the page, and it doesn't feel like right. Like you can see it acted badly, and then you think, okay, well, how can I say that so it isn't bad? and truly, it's a kind of a reductive way of coming to a character, and then you start playing with it, and then sometimes you hit on something. And go, oh yeah, if I played the character that way, then all of those problems will alleviate. I will come up with characters often from that very being, which actually can be an interesting dynamic. Like, I'm in What Is It? I'm in the next film, the one I'm shooting with my father. And my style of acting is actually a bit different than when I'm acting in other people's films because I wrote the scripts. So in a certain way, I'm not reacting in that way that I am when I'm kind of trying to fix something. Now, like River's Edge, for example, is a film I'm very proud of, but the character that I played in there was a problem to me in what I saw as the way, I didn't change any dialogue in it at all. I added one line, okay, which was okay. Listen up. That was and a couple of mans I threw in, but that was it. Everything else it was well written dialogue, but the intention of the character originally was essentially as written on the page to help his friend. What I played instead was a person that wanted to get attention for being a good person for helping his friend.
That's awesome.
That's a totally different way to play it. And now Neil Jimenez, who's a great guy, wrote the screenplay, and he openly talked about this in a very nice way at some screening later on. He said, and I knew this when we were shooting it, he thought I was ruining the movie. And there are people that have watched the film that's, you know, I've seen the comments. People think some people hate the performance. But very nicely, he came back and said, now I think it makes the film, or something to that effect, which was a very nice thing for him to say. But what the film was good on multiple levels. All the people, I think, were well cast. Dennis Hopper, all of the other actors, and Tim Hunter did a really good, sensitive job with that. But ultimately, it was a well-written screenplay. But throwing that dynamic in did put a certain depth or a certain curvature, which it did help the film. I mean, it is an annoying character. Sometimes people don't like. I think sometimes people want to go see a film because they don't want to be annoyed or something. So if you do something annoying, sometimes people just criticize you for that very reason. But or they might just think it's bad acting or whatever. All of that's fair. But you know, on some level, I'm playing a character that's playing something. So there's it can look like acting in a way, but sometimes that's okay because sometimes people do that. Yeah. So anyhow,
go ahead, John.
Oh, sorry. But your character in Reuben and Ed, that was kind of like a real kooky character. How much did you bring to that? How much was on the page
That one, I had worked with that director before in a different film called The Orkley Kid, which I liked very much. And he wrote that character with that look that I have in mind.
Yeah.
But we didn't discuss the dialogue a lot beforehand. And there were certain things that... There were times when I actually played it much angrier or crazier in a way, and he didn't want me to do it that way, which I could kind of sense. He wanted it to be a little more, I can't think of the right word, maybe average American. I can't think of the quite the right word. But that director and I had a good experience working on a different. The Orkley Kid is a very good film, so I was I was going along with things that he wanted for that, and we had a good working experience on the film. But that was not something that. I mean, there were elements that I definitely thought about in advance for that character, but I was friendly with the director for quite a while as well, so we had a dialogue going. So,
How much at a certain point, and then as we're sort of winding down, we've taken up more than an hour of your time, so I appreciate that.
Yeah,
this has been amazing.
But, I'm enjoying it.
When you're in a position where people are sort of painting you in this box sometimes of like, oh, that guy's weird, and not even really kind of giving you a chance to not be weird, does that make you want to go, well, fine, fuck you, I'll show you,
because I started acting at age 13 professionally, and I started thinking about it. I stepped into it on a business level in a way. Like, my father's an actor. He was in... Bruce Glover was in
Diamonds Are Forever,
mm-hmm. Chinatown.
Walking Tall.
There were three of them, in fact. Not the new remake, but the ones from the 70s. He originally, was it the second one? The second one was going to be with the actual guy. His name was Buford Passer. And my father tested with him and I think was helpful with the guy. And they got along and then the guy got killed. Somebody, because of what he was doing.
Right.
People were angry. Anyhow... And more recently in Ghost World, now he'll be in this film. But, my father was never like super famous or super wealthy. I grew up a middle class existence, which was fine. I have no complaints. I'm glad we weren't poor. And I'm also actually glad we weren't rich because it gave me a very clear outline that I needed to do something. So it was like I knew my parents weren't going to support me after 18 and I had to figure something out. So I saw basically how the business worked and I thought, well, this is something I could do and make work for me. So even though I was quite young and I really wasn't pushed into it, I've seen kids that are pushed into the business at a very, much younger age than 13, and it really messes them up. And that my parents didn't do that at all. They were actually kind of surprised when I said that I was interested. My father took it as a compliment. But then they were supportive. And 13 is actually strangely old if you're a kid actor. Like I saw these kid actors that were working that had established names and I was thinking, well, when am I going to work? But it was a very good age for starting out as a young actor. And then when the child labor laws started working in my favor at age 18, then I started working a lot in film. But so there's been a realistic point of view of how things work. When I was 13, I wasn't actually that artistically integrated with film as art. I'd grown up, I'd seen movies, but more television. I was relatively sophisticated about art, like I'd always admired Hieronymus Bosch or Salvador Dali, and I wrote. So I had an artistic sensibility, but I was not necessarily equating that. I thought, well, maybe it'll be neat to be in a commercial or on TV or in a movie or something. I wasn't that concerned. It wasn't until I was 16 that I started driving around to see the Revival House movies that I realized how both acting as a craft slash art can be a great thing, and of course essentially became a cinephile, a lover of movies at that time. And I forgot what you were asking.
I was asking you about like being painted into this box.
Oh, right, right. So it's like on some level, I'm a business person about it as well. I understand that there's a persona which has something to do with me. My name is, I was given the name, born with the name Crispin Hellion Glover. Sometimes I think people think that it's a made up name. It was made up by my parents. My father's middle name is Herbert. And as a struggling actor in New York, young actor in New York, he didn't like that middle name. And so he said to himself, I'm Bruce H. Glover. I'm Bruce Hellion Glover, Hellion, a troublemaker. And that made him feel good as a struggling actor. So he told my mother that was his real middle name. And then when they were married, she saw that that wasn't his middle name and thought, who am I marrying? But they gave it to me as my real
Herbert
middle
Hellion,
name.
Herbert Hellion, they're pretty close. Yeah. I mean, come on.
H-E or yeah. similar.
So you get the first two letters.
The concept of a persona is something I understood at a relatively young age. I mean, I understand where you could get upset about there's a persona that people are perceiving of you as, and maybe that isn't really you, but I don't think of my persona as me. I'm very clear that there's an external... My book, Crispin Hellion Glover, I always drew and wrote, and I always used, when I wrote and drew, my whole name, Crispin Hellion Glover. I was 14 when I... was in the screen act, got into the Screen Actors Guild, and I thought Hellion was too long of a name, Crispin Hellion Glover, so I chose Crispin Glover. And even then, I was kind of thinking, well, acting is kind of collaborative. I'll use Crispin Hellion Glover as, like, if I draw something, and Crispin Glover is a collaborative effort that I'm a part of. So I was aware of a separation. I mean, it's my name. I've been called it my whole life, but I understand that that entity, which I have something to do with, is an external entity, but other people have things to do with it too. So it's like, obviously, other people are going to say other things, and they're commenting on that element that has something to do with me, but it isn't me. If it was really about me, if I somehow genuinely, totally identified as I'm Chris, that external sure. element, I guess I'd be upset. I mean, I can get irritated. I was just, like I said, on the phone this morning with the journalist. To her benefit, she did let me talk to her again. But, you know, I can get irritated if people say. I was particularly irritated with that because what was written was that it was that I had snubbed them, which I as you can tell, I want to get my word out. I don't have anything against press. Sometimes people, you know, actors get like shy or they don't like it, which I think what that is that has to do with that they're used to the corporate shell. You know, they're paid by a corporation. And then they're living in that element. I've been in that element. I know what it's like. It's very nice. You know, there are people that do things for you, and you get driven around, and you get paid a lot of money, and it's great. But then, but that's very insular. And it's up to that corporation to make the money back for the film. You're paid, and that's kind of similar for a director that's working under corporate. We funded and distributed film. I funded my own films. I've got to make the money back. I don't have that corporate shell, so I go and I am grateful to all of the audience members. I thank them. I tell them. I talk to them afterwards, etc. And similarly, I'm grateful to the people like you guys. I'm really happy that we're talking about this stuff. This gets word out, and I also understand that there's going to be people that will say negative things. When I did press shows for the New York Times, I did a whole week run for Everything is Fine at the IFC, which is where I generally play in New York, and they've been really nice to me. But I was originally just going to do a weekend, and then it became apparent I wouldn't get reviewed in the New York Times if I didn't play the whole week. And it was right during Thanksgiving, so I had to play the show on Thanksgiving. Oh, I knew nobody. Oh, I mean, actually, people did show up, but it wasn't like a very big show, which is okay. I've played small shows. Usually it's a fairly good turnout. But I knew... And I even knew that it was plausible that the New York Times, even perhaps likely, I especially felt that when they reviewed What Is It, I thought it was likely I would get a negative review for What Is It. Surprisingly, I used both the reviews that New York Times gave me in for What Is It, or quotes from What Is It, and quotes from the review for Everything is Fine, which are some of my favorite quotes I've had. I mean, I guess you could say there were certain things that... They were fair reviews, but for me it was great. I expected just a totally negative review, but I knew as a business person it's better for the New York Times to give me a negative review than nothing at all. But surprisingly, I got good things that I use on my website now.
So just in closing, is there anything that you... a parting thought or something you want people to understand about you or something? I mean, you people can go to CrispinGlover.com
right.
as well.
Yeah.
And they can they can read your books and they can, and you have music. I know that by you worked with Barnes & Barnes.
Yeah, Barnes & Barnes.
I fucking loved Barnes & Barnes.
Yeah, they're great. They're great guys. I even have a second album with, there's Art and Artie Barnes, and Artie Barnes and I recorded the second album, which I need to get out. There's little things that need to be changed. That's kind of a whole long and involved story as well. But CrispinGlover.com, if people sign up for the newsletter on that, lets them know when and where I'll be with the films. And then there's also a Crispin Glover Twitter and a Crispin Glover, an official Crispin Helion Glover Facebook page. But the most consistent thing is signing up for the newsletter. And of course, I'm in this film that comes out.
The Bagman. It came out last week.
I think it came out last week.
Yeah, February 28th.
I think it's wider this week.
It's wider this week. Yeah, expanding this week. Yeah.
So people can find out about that. That's, you know, it's a perfect example, though, because I am here because I'm in the Bagman. I mean, I've had all of this stuff to talk about a long time ago, but Bagman, I mean, Bagman's an interesting, you know, I can't call it, it's not corporately funded. It was funded by... the director. I don't know if I haven't seen publicity about that. I don't know if he wants to hit it, but I think it's a good thing. Because I relate to it. I think there are interesting things in the film, and nuances. Sometimes people even corporately can react negatively to that. Although interestingly, with my own film, with What Is It, I found that when I first started getting corporate reviews, that's why I was kind of expecting to get negative reviews from the New York Times. I actually found when I first showed it, I premiered it at Sundance, and most of what I got, I didn't get reviewed by formal reviewers. I got reviewed by like gossip columnists.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and they were there to get like a story. So they were writing things like droves of people walking out and like what they'll try to, which isn't true. I've never had droves of people walk out on that film ever. I've had people walk out, but never droves of people out of like, and probably even less now, but like in the original years of when I played it, maybe out of, let's say 100 people or 200 people, let's say 100 people in an audience, maybe 5 people would walk out. Out of 200, maybe 8 people. You know, generally, sometimes people walk out, but really very rarely. And at the screening of Sundance, that would have been about the case. I think maybe it was like a 250-person audience. It was sold out at the Egyptian, which I think is like a 200, maybe 300-seat venue. Maybe 8 people left. So anyhow, and then what they'll do is focus on, there are things that are taboo. That's not how I sell the film. I don't go into details of what the taboos are. But what people will generally do is they'll like make a list. They'll say, this happened, this happened, this happened. Explain yourself. Or something like that. Or this, or they'll write this, or not even an interview. And then they'll write, this is why it's a bad film. But strangely, of course, it's sensationalistic, and then people go, oh, well, that's kind of interesting, and then they'll come to the movie, even though they... But I, that was initially what I was getting, was just kind of more sensationalism, kind of... they weren't formal reviewers. Then what I was surprised about was that a lot of the corporate reviewers who actually, you know, a lot of them are older and they had come from the era of looking for things that were interesting or thoughtful. I was getting, surprisingly, I think it's on Rotten Tomatoes of what is it, and I think it has like 57%, which is more people giving it a good review. I know it's called Splat on that, although everything is fine. I really expected it to be a much more aggressive negative reviewership, whereas Everything is Fine is a fresh. That's like 80, I don't know, it's something good, 70, 80 something percent.
I think 78 and above is fresh.
So. Yeah, yeah, and it's and Everything is Fine is fresh. I mean, and to be, I understand why that is. It was kind of what I was talking about. There's an emotional catharsis that happens in the film, and people can get behind it, and rightfully so. I'm very proud of that film, but I'm proud of What Is It in a lot of different ways as well.
Well, there's you know, I think, obviously there's a variety of different ways that people can watch a film, but a lot of times it's, you know, people are watching almost as a voyeur, where they're going, oh, there's a story and there's something that's happening and I'm kind of getting on board that story and following along. And there are other films. And the first film for me that I ever saw like that did this to me when I was young was like The Wall. I think The Wall, maybe, yeah. Where it was like, ugh, like it just felt like, I couldn't explain why, but it was just like reaching into my chest and fucking around with my soul. And I was like, this is making me feel things and I don't understand, you know, like.
So how old were you when The Wall came out?
Well, I was young. I mean, I was young. Yeah, I was alive. I mean,
right.
I didn't see it until, you know, I saw The Wall probably around the same time I saw Harold and Maude, which was like on VHS in the mid 80s. You
right.
know, when
so,
I was like 12 or 13.
How old are you? I don't know.
I'm 42.
Okay, so yeah, you're about 8 years younger than me.
Yeah, so when I saw it, I was like just barely a teenager, mm-hmm. and just barely any younger than that. I don't think I would have been able to process it really. But I was just sort of like, oh,
The teenage years are really important. Starting around 13, I think you get a really. I've always thought that 13 is like the year that you can really start to formulate opinions about what is not cool.
Sure.
Like, so I was 13, in 1977, I was 13, and I like really disliked disco because that was the year of disco. And so when you're 13, like, that's the age where you're starting to like, you know, like girls or what, and so you start noticing like adult sexuality, and or at least that's how it was for me. Like I was starting to have perception of what people thought was cool, and I could see that disco is like there are these people that were kind of out of shape and wearing these polyester shirts and doing these formulated dance moves that they weren't that good at, and it just looked really embarrassing to me. So I had this kind of disdain for it, and I feel like anybody that's 13, like whatever is considered cool right now, they're probably looking at it going, no, yeah. That's
well, I think
really
that's because
not.
As hormones start flooding your body, I think that's where you start becoming aware. That's where you start becoming aware because you start going, oh, I will start wanting to attract something.
Yes, yeah. Right.
I have a friend that has a theory that like if you ask someone their favorite movie, most times it'll be a movie they saw when they were 12 or 13.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean,
for me it was 16, but I can see where that happens.
In that time.
Yeah.
Well, also especially because when something really connects with you, you've never had quite that experience before.
Yeah.
And so this is why a lot of films you go back and watch and you go, I liked that, you know, but like when you were younger, you go, oh my, you know,
like,
yeah,
but
really.
Like, but at the same time, like I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey when I was, four and a half years old.
Oh, wow. Jesus.
Because my parents and I, when we first moved to L.A., I was born in New York, and we moved to L.A. in 67 because my father was getting more work here than New York. So I was 3 and a half. So I don't remember the exact year, but in the first years that we were here, we would go to the drive-in movie theater. So I remember which movies we saw at the drive-in, and one of them was I'd hide in the back because it was cheaper.
Yeah.
Under the blanket. And then we'd get a Kentucky bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, which I wouldn't want to eat these days. But then it was great. And so Yeah, I mean, I remember a number of the movies we saw at that time. But one of them was 2001: A Space Odyssey, and I liked it. You know, I was three and a half or four, whatever it was, and it was, or maybe I was five, somewhere in that area, whatever year it came out, or maybe the year after because it was a drive-in run. But that definitely was a movie that stuck with me. And then it was later, I think I saw Dr. Strangelove on television, and I think I started realizing, oh, this is the same guy who did that. And then I probably The Shining I saw in the movie theater, and by then I was quite aware. And then I saw a re-release of Clockwork Orange when I was 18. I think those are the orders of seeing. And oh, wow. He's one of my, as so many, rightfully so, one of the great, my you know, idols of filmmaking. But so that's a movie. I did also see Freaks at a very young age.
Oh, wow,
my father took my mother and I to see it at the New Art. I don't remember the year, but I did have one of those cassette recorders that were relatively new. It had like a button in the middle that you...
Oh, yeah, the knob. And you
the knob in the middle. And I made a recording the next day playing the German small fellow who's the protagonist of the film.
Gwabble?
What's that?
Like the little Gweeble Gwabble, Gweeble Gwabble?
No, well, I mean, no. His character, Gweeble Wobble, is... I don't know who says that, but no, he's the guy that the woman marries for his money.
Yes, exactly.
Does he say Weeble Wobble?
Well, they all do at the end. I thought that
that's
was the thing.
At the marriage, they're saying Gweeble
Gobble, Gweeble Gobble,
one of us. Yeah, which is, that seems great.
Well, that's a perfect. I think that's a perfect way to wrap this up by saying Crispin Glover, one of us, one of us, one of us.
Thank you. It's a compliment.
It's really been a pleasure. It's been so great talking to you. And CrispinGlover.com. People should see you live if they can. See the Bagman, read your books.
Absolutely.
And thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Great time.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.